So one of the things that I really admire Steve Jobs for is his incredible ability to focus. To focus not only on the few things that matter, but on the fewest things that are essential. Welcome, dear listener. Welcome, dear leader of the pack, dear Lightwolf community member. Welcome to this wonderful conversation today, which is a very special one in two ways. First, we are going to flip the format in terms of interviewer and interviewee. Typically, when I'm doing interviews, and maybe you remember the interview I've done with Barry DeQuan about a year ago on his fields of expertise, typically I'm interviewing. Today, we flip, and Barry is back, and I will be the interviewee answering Barry's questions. Because Barry and I, we go together, we go a long way together, we know each other well, and I'm honored that today Barry is back in this Lightwolf podcast. This podcast goes back to a dinner conversation that Barry and I have had last year, and we just chatted about mutual experiences. I learned from Barry. Barry was interested and quite intrigued about my learning from having worked with Steve Jobs for 1 year. And that's the start of it. That's the start of this whole conversation today. So today I'm here with Barry in flipped roles. Barry is going to interview me on my experience having worked with Steve Jobs. So welcome, Barry.
Thank you, Stefan. It's a joy and an honor to be here with you today.
So thank you. And for you, the audience, for you, the listener, let me reintroduce Barry DeQuan to you. Close friend. We share values. We share values deeply. A few facts that I'd like you to be aware of about Barry DeQuan. Barry is a dedicated leader with deep, deep passion for learning, growth, and development through the power of community, relationships, and meaningful connections. Originally from Canada, Barry spent over 30 years working internationally in the field of education, bringing a wealth of global experience into his own leadership. He currently serves as the director of the International School of Zug and Lucerne, a vibrant community of 1,200 students representing more than 65 countries and nationalities. Barry was instrumental in designing the vision and the mission of ISDL, and its mission is to be a community of learners committed to making the world and our corner of it a better and kinder place. Barry offers a unique perspective on fostering growth, well-being, and development with an unwavering belief in the transformative power of striving for continuous improvement and meaningful impact every day. He is a fantastic leader, and I'm honored to be with you again here, Barry, today. So again, welcome to this conversation.
Thank you so much, Stefan. You're very kind.
Yeah, so let's... I'm not, as you know. And for you, the audience, to understand why I'm not, there are many things why I highly respect Barry as a leader, as a professional, and as a personality. And in terms of just highlighting one of the accomplishments, it must have been 2 or 3 years ago, Barry, that ISDL participated in a global series of awards and a global competition with, I think, 48 different schools. And I'm not surprised at all that ISDL won 3 first prizes, including the one of best school. So you are an expert, you are a high performer, you do something great. And I really look forward to this exchange now, Barry. Over to you.
Thank you so much, Stefan. Let's just jump right in. As you said, I really appreciated our lunch. And as I was learning from you and your experiences with Steve Jobs, I thought, my goodness, there's such an opportunity here for others to learn from this same conversation. So I think lunch started this way, Stefan. How did you come to work with Steve Jobs on the launch of the first iPhone outside of the United States?
Yeah, honestly, a lot of luck. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time without really deserving that. It was luck. So in my professional career, after spending 18 years in a company that shaped me, a great global consumer goods company with an American soul, I served at Procter & Gamble. I decided to join T-Mobile in 2006. And it was in Jan 2007 that Steve Jobs and his Apple team launched the successful first iPhone into the United States. They then decided, after this first roaring success, this needs to go global. We go beyond the US. The first country to launch is Germany. And the partner of choice is T-Mobile. And I was lucky to be one of the general managers at the time, responsible for marketing and sales. So I was becoming unexpectedly responsible for launching this outstanding revolutionary device into the world outside the US. I had a prototype for a few days. It just took me 2 days to get on fire. So that's how I ended up being responsible for leading our 7,500 people organization to launch the first iPhone launch in Germany in 2007. So a lot of luck.
And thank you for that. And when you first met Steve Jobs, before that encounter, what did you envision that encounter being like? And then actually, what was it like in reality?
I encountered Steve in two ways. First, on email, and second, live. On email, I was thrilled about his incredible visionary skills combined with exceptional focus skills. So the first couple of encounters were either via the team or via email. And I have never met anyone else, Barry, who had both of those often contradictory skills, i.e. high visionary skills and creativity. Typically, people who have that skill set are not that strong on focus and structure. While some others who are strong on focus and structure are typically not that strong on vision and creativity. Steve Jobs, in my life, is the individual I met with the highest combination of both. And first, on the exchanges on email, defining the pricing structure, defining the pricing strategy, defining the launch product for that launch in Germany, I encountered a quite rational, focused, short-lipped leader. That's the Steve I perceived in the many exchanges we had before meeting in person. And then in September 2007, when I had a day with him live and a small group of people, when he in fact launched the iPhone to the world outside the US with just a few others and me in the room, I perceived a gentleman who was focused, a little bit even disconnected, I would say, but I understand why, because he was launching a big thing to the world. But he felt a little bit disconnected from us while being 2 meters away from me. Very focused and concentrated on his performance and easy to connect thinking-wise. On an intellectual level, it was very easy to connect with him and get into great conversations, while on an emotional level, it was a bit harder to connect.
Thanks for sharing that. Based on that experience and further experiences working with him, how did that shape your own leadership? If you had to look back at that moment, every experience we have with other leaders, we tend to take some of that into our own leadership. How do you think that shaped your own?
In many ways. Let me highlight a few. The strongest one is focus. I don't know how you feel, Barry, but I do know from now 170 firms we are serving and about 35 CEOs I'm working with personally, I know there was a common theme in our times today, which is the scarcity of time. We are getting more and more things done in the same 24 hours. and many more things than 20 years ago, before the iPhone was launched. So one of the things that I really admire Steve Jobs for is his incredible ability to focus. To focus not only on the few things that matter, but on the fewest things that are essential. I experienced this when he just told us, guys from T-Mobile Germany, I know your five-pronged tariff structure. Let's not waste any time debating this. The iPhone pricing strategy will have three levels. Good, better, best. End of story. Yeah. And Barry, our reaction when we read these lines and heard these words was kind of twofold. We were a little bit kind of alerted to the somewhat disproportionate distribution of power in this relationship, in this partnership. But I was also thrilled by the clarity of thinking. Yeah. Because I was reminded by this focus on three, this magic of three things, right? I was reminded of my own lessons learned. And you as a learner, as a teacher, Barry, you know as well, no human being can memorize 10 things. It's even hard to memorize five. Four may be possible, but borderline. But three is possible. So this magic focus on just three, I found thrilling. It energized me a lot. So this focus on just three essentials is one of the key lessons I learned from working with Steve Jobs. Another one is on strategy. If I'm asked to summarize strategy in one word, it's choice. Making decisions what to do and what not to do. Making decisions on where to play and where not to play. And this courage to say no is the second thing I've learned from working with Steve Jobs. So these would be two of many, many highlights. The necessity to focus on the few essentials and his mastery of that discipline. And the second one, particularly in the context of strategy, decision-making, choice, the courage to say no.
Well, Stefan, that resonates so much with me as I continue to grow and learn from my own mistakes as a leader. It keeps coming back to those two topics for myself also. Simplicity, getting to that idea of focus, and strategy and choice. It's all connected. There's too much, it just doesn't get done well. The more narrow the focus you have and the more clarity we have around what we're trying to achieve, it's easier to get ourselves aligned and everyone else aligned on that journey. I'd like to build on something you said around Steve Jobs being exceptional at both his ability to balance visionary thinking with meticulous attention to detail. That can lead to quite an intensive environment, I would imagine. And a lot of people work in environments that can be quite intensive. So what did you learn from working in an intense environment? What strategies did you invoke to make sure that you were successful in your own endeavors?
Yeah, I think it has to do with this combination of the intellectual component of decision-making and the emotional component of decision-making. Your question and my experience having worked with Steve Jobs remind me of one thing where I am a big learner, a field that I'm not yet as good as I'd like to be, which is connecting, right? Mm-hmm. Connecting. And also creating the feeling of connectedness, strengthening relationships. So when I remember the decisions that I recommended to him, and I sometimes recommended things that I still think were better plans than his decisions. But at the same time, then reading his decisions on email or hearing his decisions live, it reminded me of, on the one hand side, the power of taking informed decisions and saying no to alternatives, to all alternatives. It's so, so empowering to do so because you get so clear. Yeah, you're so bloody clear on the few focus areas. And you also, in a strange way, you feel supported by the no, because you now feel relieved. Those seven things I don't need to do. They won't be expected. They won't even be tolerated with Steve Jobs, right? But now I feel so relieved because I can use that time for those seven things that I'm not going to do. I'm going to use that time for the two things we are going to do. So it's somehow relieving. It's intellectually clarifying. And that's, I think, the great side of Steve Jobs' decision-making skills. Now, there comes an emotional side alongside, which in my perception was not necessarily his key strengths. Let me give you an example. We planned to launch iPhone number one in Germany on July the 1st, 2007. Me being responsible for 7,500 employees in the T-Mobile organization and leveraging Deutsche Telekom's customer service and sales network, there must have been around about 22,000 people lined up to launch the iPhone on July the 1st. But just 3 weeks prior to the launch, we receive a short email from Cupertino, California, Apple headquarter, saying, launch postponed. End of story. No explanation why, no new timing, and me puzzled, because I had informed 22,000 people to launch on July the 1st. And I didn't know why we postponed. I didn't know until when we postponed. And that kind of communication, to me, is not really an example of complete great leadership, Barry. So that's one example where I felt like, okay, it would have been helpful to understand a bit better and to feel more connected to the why and the what's next. Yeah? So that's a side where maybe he just chose to be efficient. But at least the impact he had on me and on my team over here in Germany was probably not exactly the impact he wanted. And that, in my perception, could have been an area where he could have connected more on an emotional side. Yeah. So but that was his choice. Yeah.
And Stefan, I'm interrupting you because I don't want to lose this thread. In that moment, how did you manage that situation with your team and manage yourself for that matter?
Yeah. A very good point, because I was puzzled for about 5 seconds, but then tried to kind of calm down, disconnect a bit, and remind myself that I shouldn't fall into the trap of now fearing and scaring the unknown. Just disconnect and just remind myself there will be a reason for this. Mm-hmm. The reason will be a good reason. And even if I don't know it, this is a fact now. We will have to postpone the launch. Yeah? So we went back to the team. We had a conversation and then managed to calm everybody down and to inform people to, first of all, keep them to course, right? This was not canceling the launch, which maybe some of them could have been confused of or scared of. It was postponing the launch, and there will be a good reason. And this is a complex thing. As I learned much later, Barry, I learned months after the launch, we probably made the wrong assumption. The assumption was we did launch the iPhone in the US together with T-Mobile successfully. So it works in the US. And probably we assumed a bit too much that the combination of hardware US and software T-Mobile US transferred to Germany is like a plug and play. It's going to work. And most likely, some of these assumptions were proven wrong 3 weeks before the launch, which means we just had to do some more work to make sure that the European version of the iPhone product and the software systems and my network from T-Mobile in Germany had to be reconnected with much more effort than we had anticipated. I was never told this was the reason, but that's what I made up afterwards. That might have been the reason. And so I just tried to calm down immediately. There will be a reason. It will be a good reason. Let's accept what we can't change and then influence what we can and move on.
And building on that, Stefan, and thanks so much. This is fantastic. Building on what you just said, by design, a key aspect of the launch of the iPhone was its disruptive impact. And that was by design. What did you learn from Steve Jobs and how to manage, successfully manage a change process of that nature?
A lot. First, I admire Steve Jobs' uncompromising focus on product quality and easy user experience, because that's the heart of the success of the iPhone, and in my perception, at the heart of the success of Apple as a company still today. So this relentless focus on quality and on user experience, I perceived within 24 hours, March 2007. The US launch just had taken off. The German launch was still a few months away. I was one of a few people who received a prototype iPhone, number one. And being the chief marketing officer of T-Mobile Germany, I anyway used many devices in parallel. I was a BlackBerry fan at the time. That was my primary device. I used a Nokia smartphone or mobile phone at the time, because Nokia had a 50% global market share at the time. Every second device was Nokia. Do you remember, Barry?
I do very well.
And then my third device was the most innovative device, which at the time often was Sony Ericsson. So I was using BlackBerry, Nokia, and Sony Ericssons, while my global CEO came in the door and said, Stefan, we succeeded. We got the launch. Here is the prototype. Try it, and no pressure, but you make sure that the whole thing works, okay? So then I swapped out the Sony. I started playing with this iPhone prototype. And in my case, and I like anyone, Apple is not perfect in everything. But this experience, it took me one night and one morning to fall in love with the intuitive simplicity of these smartphones, maneuvering tiles, nowadays we call them apps or applications, maneuvering apps versus pressing buttons. So this relentless focus on creating those products in quality, on intuitively simple user experience, was conceptually the biggest learning I made from him. Just ruthlessly uncompromising focus on high quality and intuitively simple user experience.
So Steve Jobs had a reputation for setting very high standards, as you've just illustrated. How did he manage to demand these standards? And importantly, how did he enforce them?
Let me share an anecdote that I've heard from my partner, who was kind of my direct partner, who was in Cupertino, and who shared an experience right after Steve Jobs having launched the iPhone into Germany and the world. Live in Berlin, September 2007. So I go to this gentleman, I go over and say, so, hey, how are you? How did you like this? Yeah, it was very good. So how are you doing in Cupertino these days? And he went like, honestly, not good at all. And I go like, why? You and your boss just launched the iPhone to the world. You should be happy all over the place. He said, yeah, but you know, Stefan, we long started working on iPhone number 2, which is the upgrade. And last week we had a meeting in Cupertino, and that in my perception was a little bit controversial. You know, I said, why? Yeah, it was a 9 hours meeting, and it was scheduled for 9 a.m. to 6 p.m, and they were people flying in from all the way from Boston, over to San Francisco from an advertising agency, four people flying in for 4 hours. And then there was another group of people from Florida, from the PR agency, flying in from Florida to San Francisco for a one-day meeting. And of course, everyone is in the room before nine. At 9 o'clock, Steve Jobs comes in on the minute and asks me, so good morning, how are you? So what's the topic today? Ah, yeah, iPhone number 2. I understand. Dirk, can you please give me the prototype? And Barry, the prototype is the one and only iPhone number 2 that about 80 people spent 6 months on 24/7 to build. One product, one prototype. He says, okay, give me the prototype. Can I please have a glass of water? And then he takes the glass of water and he drops the iPhone prototype, the one and only, into that glass of water. And all of a sudden, coming up are bubbles, because there was air inside the device. And that has been at the time, and probably still is, the biggest challenge of that industry today, i.e. compaction, making the products compact. So as I heard from this gentleman, Steve apparently asks, so Dirk, what do you see? And the man responded, well, I see a few bubbles. But Steve, you got to understand, this is by far the most compact device that Apple has ever built. You're not answering my question. What do you see there? And he says, yeah, Steve, I see a few bubbles coming up. But this is by far the best product, the most compact device the world has ever seen. Is this the best that Apple is capable of? And Dirk responds, honestly, well, this is the best we've ever done, but it is conceivable that we might do even better in terms of compaction. So it's 2 minutes past 9 o'clock, Barry, in a meeting that's scheduled to be 9 hours. And Steve Jobs apparently has said, ladies and gentlemen, this meeting is finished. We do not have a product. Let's not waste any time. Get back to your work and let's reconvene when we have a product. End of meeting, end of story. So at 9:02, he leaves the room and the meeting is over, right? Now, I think there is two ways how to look at this, Barry. One interpretation is, excuse my French, what a disrespectful behavior of this man with 28 people in the room, 8 of whom have taken a flight from the other side of the continent to be in this meeting. What a disrespectful behavior to call this off 2 minutes after beginning. That's one interpretation which I would understand. The other interpretation, much more intellectual and rational, is, well, what a radical focus. What an efficient use of time. Why waste 28 man days if the product isn't ready, right? And I think it's in the eye of the interpreter, and it's in the audience and in you and in me to choose the interpretation. To what extent was this disrespectful? And to what extent was this just radical focus and efficiency?
Incredible story, Stefan. 2 minutes in. It leads me to my next question, actually. It's a good segue. You've touched on this already. You said there are aspects of Steve Jobs' leadership style that you thought was highly effective, but other areas that you shared may have not been his greatest strengths. So were there aspects of his leadership that you consciously do differently because they do not match your own leadership style?
Yeah, at least I try to. Yeah. So let me first maybe reiterate many, many things I really envy and admire in Steve Jobs. His visionary, his strategic leadership, his focus, his relentless focus on quality are, I think, at the heart of Apple's success still today. There is no doubt that he is an exceptionally strong and impactful leader. But like every leader, he has his strengths and his weaknesses. Everyone does. I do. Every leader I've seen has strengths and weaknesses. And the one thing that I have learned from working with him that I consciously try to do differently from him is in decision making. It's not about the way to make the decision. There I'm still trying to learn from him how he does it. But it's about communicating the decision. I'm trying to make it a habit that when I am taking a tough, controversial decision, that I communicate the decision and the one key reason why I'm taking the decision the way I do. I do not expect people to agree with me. And I think, Barry, also you lead hundreds of people. The people we lead do not necessarily expect us to do what they want. But I'm firmly convinced they have a right to understand the why. And that's something that Steve repeatedly did not do with me. And that's something that I'm consciously doing the opposite. I do a lot to make sure that when I'm taking a controversial decision, I'm articulating the one key reason why, so that people can at least understand and buy in.
That's incredibly powerful. I feel the same way, Stefan. I think it's important to have clarity on the why ourselves and not to be afraid to communicate it out. Not everyone may agree, but that's okay. I think there's respect and trust in communicating a clear why around decisions and standing behind them. A little bit related to this, Steve Jobs' career was marked by some dramatic highs and lows. What did you observe about how he navigated adversity and change, and how leaders can use those lessons to lead through uncertain times that we're experiencing right now?
Yeah. One thought I'm getting from him, and I wish I had had more time with him. I wish I had had an opportunity for a one-on-one, which I never had. But one of the lessons I take in reflecting about him on your question is this strong confidence in following his vision. He must have had a vision about how we are navigating our lives today, how we are using digital devices today, 3 decades ago, probably before the internet was known to you and me. Yeah, one of the things I remember I've learned about him is that probably sometimes in the early or mid-90s, when the Apple company did not do well at all, he recommended to his board to invest about $20 million into a new technology, which was touching glass with your finger, inducing an electric impulse on the backside of the glass. Again, of course, I have not been in the room in the moment, Barry, but I wouldn't be surprised if we had looked into some strange faces of the supervisory board who he, as the CEO, was asking permission to invest the $20 million. Probably some of those people thought, hey, Steve, did you smoke? Why do you even remotely consider wasting $20 million on such a waste at a time when Apple is in trouble, right? So probably many did not want to approve his recommendation on this. So why did he, though, push this through, and why did he believe in it? Because he had a 20 years foresight, probably anticipating that nowadays that same technology of touching glass and inducing an electrical impulse is the key interface between your hand, Barry, and your smartphone. And he saw that 2 decades in advance, right? So this enormous power to see the future, combined with this confidence and his willpower to invest a targeted amount of resources, a limited but still $20 million, to invest money and time to explore these innovations, is one of the things I find spectacular in Steve Jobs.
If you don't mind, I'll try and reflect back what you just said in a slightly different way. The question was around how leaders can use those lessons to lead through uncertain times. What I heard from you was to be really clear on the why, the vision and the why behind it. And that's a grounding exercise through really difficult times where you're being challenged. And it forces us to come back to that why. But it gives us that direction and confidence to go forward. That's what I heard from you.
Absolutely. And I would like to add a second one, which is let's get comfortable with discomfort. When I think about the many, many people that my team is honored to serve in our company, then we often encounter discomfort coming from the uncertainty. Maybe Steve Jobs himself, when he made this recommendation, had a certain level of discomfort in himself. Because, of course, he could not know at the time whether these $20 million invested would ever return. Right? But I think one of the things that I'm also working on myself on is to get more and more comfortable with discomfort. Yeah? We cannot know the future. And we still have to deliver results. So we have to take these decisions, not knowing whether they are right, which makes us uncomfortable. But one of the things I also admired in him was, at least towards the outside world, he often seemed comfortable when attacked. He felt comfortable with being made uncomfortable, right? And that's a skill, I think, that we can learn from him. Let's just accept, when we look into the future, there are some things we know. Let's say them. There are some things we don't know. Let's articulate them with the same honor and honesty. And let's articulate what we are going to do to find out. But let's get comfortable with discomfort.
I couldn't agree more. If we want to ensure we're making the right decisions, we need to sit in that discomfort of knowing we don't know everything and opening space for others to be critical and to challenge our thinking, see new ways of doing things. And that can be very uncomfortable, which can lead to uncomfortable conversations. It's not personal. It's a good process. And in fact, even if on a leadership team, when I reflect on this, if there isn't at least one person that is pushing back and challenging, I would almost like to designate someone just to do that by design. So we don't get too comfortable with ourselves as a team and the decisions we're making.
Yeah, I completely agree. And again, building on your point, Barry, one of the things that he reminds me of, but I'm making a connection now to a supervisory board where I'm serving on a board of a charity. The charity is called Reboot the Future, mm-hmm. Founded by Kim Pohlman, a wonderful personality. And a great company where I feel honored that I can make a few contributions. One of the things that Reboot the Future has is a great video on imaginal cells, a great book from Kim, Imaginal Cells, using the analogy to the transformation of a caterpillar to a butterfly as an analogy to symbolize transformation. And what I learned from Kim's fantastic book is that this caterpillar at some point in time goes through resistance in a very tough way, because apparently the immune system of the caterpillar even tried to suppress the development of the eyes in the soon-to-be butterfly at some point in time in the transformation when this liquid body starts to get more and more solid, right? But this butterfly keeps on transforming, solidifying, and then at the end of this transformation, suddenly opening up the wings and starting to fly. So what I'm learning from this is when we are involved in change processes, and Steve Jobs was one of the most disruptive change agents in mankind, in the history of mankind. When we are involved in change, or when we are even leading change, we should expect resistance. Yeah? When I was a young guy, Barry, my teens and 20s, I was very glad when change went smoothly. I was slightly nervous when there was resistance and controversy and conflict. I've changed my thinking again completely upside down, partly challenged and supported by a reboot, but also just informed by my life. Nowadays, I'm getting nervous when there is no resistance, right? Because humans by nature, me included, we are comfortable. We prefer comfort over change. We prefer change going without us having to be busy. Yeah? Change is great. Why don't you start? Yeah? But that's not the way it goes. If we want to change something, and I love change, yeah? If we want to change something, we just need to expect discomfort, because change inevitably leads everyone involved out of the comfort zone into new territory. And that means we should expect resistance from people, and we should help them overcome their own resistance. Yeah. So I think disruptive change, as personified by Steve Jobs as well, comes with discomfort and resistance in the organization. We should expect it as leaders and deal with it.
Very well stated. Stefan, I would like to continue this conversation all day. I'm really enjoying this time with you, but we probably should start moving to wrapping up. You've been generous with your stories and your personal reflections, and maybe to try and summarize what we've learned today, I'll ask you two questions in the area of a personal reflection. So here's the first one. When you look back on your year working with Steve Jobs, are you able to identify one lesson that strikes you as being the most valuable for you, and why?
There are many, but the one I would like to highlight is to have the courage to say no. Having the courage to say no is the prerequisite for being able to focus our limited time on the few essential things that matter the most. And when I was a young man, I was pretty bad at that. I have turned to be much better at it, but I'm still a learner on how to politely and respectfully say no to the many options that in isolation look attractive, so that I have enough capacity, I have enough time to invest into the two or three essential things that matter the most for success. And I think that's the key lesson that I learned from working with Steve Jobs.
Thank you for that. And here's the second question. Is there a quote or a statement or a phrase from your time working with Steve Jobs that has particularly stuck in your mind and still inspires you today?
Yeah, it does. I think it's from a speech that Steve Jobs has given on Stanford campus, whatever, 18, 20 years ago. I've seen the video a couple of times. I'm quoting now out of memory. Maybe it's not literally the words he said, but the thought he shared was the following when he addressed Stanford students. He said something like, "Ladies and gentlemen, in leading your lives, don't get upset with the opinion of others. Don't let their noise confuse you and drown your dreams. Have the courage to follow your heart and your intuition. They already know who you want to become." Yeah? And that thought, Barry, resonates very deeply with me. Also, when I think about my kids, my own boys, and you know them, I think it's easy in today's world to get drowned by noise, by those many things that compete for our attention in every second. And one of the lessons I've learned, also from a great book from an Australian author, Bronnie Ware, on what makes happiness, is we need to define ourselves who we want to be. And that's more important in the long term than following the advice of God and the world around us, right? So that one quote, I think, is the one that inspired me a lot, among many others. But have the courage to follow your intuition and heart. They already know who you want to become.
That's beautifully stated, Stefan. And I can't think of a more apropos way to wrap up this incredible conversation today. As I just said, thank you so much for your generosity in sharing your stories and your personal reflections. I know I've learned a lot today, and I have a lot to reflect on myself. So thank you.
Yeah. The pleasure is all mine, Barry. I feel grateful for you being in this Lightwolf podcast today and being not only my partner, but my interviewer here and guiding this conversation. It was a pleasure to be together with you again. And in the name of the entire Lightwolf community, a 5-digit number of people joining this community on and off, I would like to say thank you to you for investing your time, for being with us, for having this conversation around leadership and around learning from someone who had a lot to share. So thank you very much, dear Barry de Kwan.
It's been my pleasure and honor.
Great. I hope you enjoyed it, dear Lightwolf audience, dear member of this community. I hope you have taken one little nugget out of this conversation that might inform your thinking on leadership, that might help you develop yourself into exactly the leader you want to become. So thank you to you, Barry de Kwan, for leading this. And thank you to you, our listener, for investing your time to be with us today. I can't wait to welcome you again to the next episode of the Lightwolf podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it. Have a great day and see you soon. Thank you. Thank you, Barry.
Thank you, Stefan. Thank you, everyone.